You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Alongside the rapid spread of the novel coronavirus has been a rise in anxiety. What are the psychological states of COVID-19? How can we respond to fear and anxiety amid the threat and uncertainty? Lillian Ng, senior lecturer in medicine at the University of Auckland, discusses with Dr. Rob Sheaf.
I'm talking today with Rob Sheaf, who is a psychiatrist working in general adult psychiatry. He is a specialist in cognitive behavioral therapy and has a special interest in anxiety disorders. So today we're going to be talking about psychological states related to the threat of COVID-19. At this time, there's a lot of fear and anxiety about what's happening in the world, fear of becoming ill and in this pared back state and with life in a holding pattern. People feel very worried about how COVID will affect them and fearful. So can we speak a little bit about fear and anxiety? What are they and what is the difference between them?
Both fear and anxiety are widespread, they're universal, they affect every living organism, and they've been part of our experience as humans since day dot. We all feel fear, we all feel anxiety. It's a self-protective alarm system. It's what keeps us safe when we're faced with danger. But there is an important difference between fear and anxiety. Fear occurs when we are in the presence of something that's risky or dangerous. If there's a snake in my room at the moment, I'm very likely to demonstrate fear. Anxiety is the emotion that we feel in response to thinking about something that might be risky or dangerous in the future. So if I think that I might be going to a country where there might be snakes, I might become anxious about that. It's a worry, it's a thought process where we become apprehensive at the prospect that we might encounter something risky or dangerous that we wouldn't be able to keep ourselves safe from.
And I suppose in this lockdown state, there's a persistent fear, isn't there, or chronic apprehension, and people are scanning their environment and quite vigilant about the future. So it might cause us to be quite cautious or even avoidant in how we think about the future and how we act.
Well, absolutely. It's a period of enormous uncertainty. Again, there's a public awareness about illness and disease. We all know about diseases. We all know about infections. And added to that, there are so many sources of perhaps not particularly helpful information in movies, and there are endless computer games, board games about pandemics and infections, so it's all in our awareness. But despite that, it's a time of enormous uncertainty, and I think that's where a lot of our anxiety lives. Anxiety grows on doubt and uncertainty. As soon as we know what it is that we're dealing with, our anxiety does tend to reduce a little bit. It's like being terribly scared of the dark until you turn the lights on and realize either that there's nothing there to be scared of or there's something in front of us that we need to take action either to run away from or to defend ourselves from. But as soon as we know what it is that we're dealing with, then the information that generates does tend to shrink anxiety in a very helpful way.
And we know there is evidence about the psychological effects, say, from the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s. So people became unwell and they were anxious about getting a fever. They were anxious about the lethality of illness, and there's a sort of separation from loved ones. And we know people in our community have various responses depending on their situations. How does the body respond to anxiety? And how does that translate to the way we behave?
Anxiety just has an incredibly pervasive impact on our bodies. Every organ system that we have has a responsiveness to anxiety. But the more characteristic physical manifestations of anxiety would include experiences like an increase in heart rate or an increase in the forcefulness of our heartbeat. We tend to get a dry mouth. Our breathing tends to dysregulate. We can breathe too quickly or too shallowly. We can hold our breaths when we're anxious, but all of that tends to create a feeling of shortness of breath or tightness in our chest. Our muscles tense up when we're anxious, and that tends to make us trembly or shaky. We get sweaty. It affects our bladder and bowel. Oftentimes we need to empty our bowel, or we get a feeling that we have to go to the toilet to empty our bladder. When we start to breathe irregularly, it changes our perception. We tend to notice changes in visual perception. We get flashes and crinkles in our eyesight. Our vision gets distorted. We can feel lightheaded, as if we're going to faint, all of which are horrible. And what we tend to do when we feel anxious, either the emotion of anxiousness or the physical experience of anxiousness, we want to get away from it because it's unpleasant. And the characteristic behavioral response that happens when we get anxious is avoidance. And that goes back to, I think everybody's probably heard of Charles Darwin. He did some very original research into how humans behave when they feel anxious. And the characteristic responses are to fight something. If there's something in our environment that's making us anxious, we want to fight it to get rid of it, to freeze in the face of anxiety, or the very common one is to flee. So fear, fight, and flee are the common behavioural responses. And these days, the things that we tend to do most is to try and avoid something that we're anxious of.
And just on thinking about the surge in arousal that comes from panicking, and thinking about how that translates into perhaps some of the panic behaviours and the sensations of panic that people experience. I mean, people already are quite sleep deprived when they're anxious. And do you want to talk a little bit about what happens when people have that extreme state where they literally shut down?
Of panic? I think it's sometimes quite helpful to think about anxiety on a spectrum, or like a volume knob that goes from very little, if we were measuring a line that was, say, 0 to 10, very little anxiety, which would be down the 1 or 2, and we'd have words for that, like feeling a bit fretful or a bit uneasy. And then as the dial increases, we have different words that would attach to that, like feeling worried or scared or frightened, terrified. Right up the top of the dial would be words like panic. And it's not that it's a different experience, it's the same experience, but the dial's turned up much higher. And the importance of that, really, I think, in terms of helping people with anxiousness, is that it's much, much easier to manage anxiety, to contain anxiety, if we're dealing with it when it's relatively low down on the scale. And that's true for anything. Pain is easier to deal with if it's not too strong. Sadness is. And anxiety, certainly, if we're good at noticing when we're getting a little bit anxious, it's much, much easier to put it out. It's a bit like a fire. It's much easier to stand on a little smolder than try and put out an out-of-control bushfire.
Can you explain a little bit about what happens to the brain and stress hormones when we're exposed to stimuli that evoke fear?
Because our basic need as organisms, I guess, humans or organisms, is to keep ourselves alive. And the thing that's going to most help to keep us alive is to keep away from things that are dangerous. So all our senses, our smell, sight, hearing, feelings on our skin, all tunes into our environment to look for signs of threat, so that when we perceive something, when we see something or hear something that's threatening, it goes directly into a very primitive part of our brain called our amygdala, which is a little almond-shaped bit deep inside our brain stem, which is a little bit like a threat detector. And if our amygdala gets information from our senses, and this happens in fractions of microseconds, it fires off a huge volley of chemical and electrical messages to important brain structures that mediate the fear response. And most of these happen deep down in our brainstem, well away from our cortex, which is our thinking brain. These are things that happen kind of subconsciously or away from our voluntary control. It hits directly into our breathing, our heart rate. It connects to our hormone system, and we get a flood of stress-mediating hormones. I guess the one we relate to or understand most commonly is a hormone called cortisol, which spikes very, very quickly with anxiousness, and it serves to gear our body up so that we can mobilize what we need to get ourselves out of harm's way.
And they're going into overdrive at the moment, I think, with a lot of the chronic stress that people are experiencing. You talked about some of those circuits and the hormonal response. It's the loss of daily routines that provide normality that produces all sorts of normal and abnormal emotional states. And can we talk about some of those?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I always sound a bit old-fashioned when I talk to people how important day routine is, but I just can never overestimate the importance of having structure in our lives. If our routine, if our environment's organized and structured and predictable, we tend to feel internally organized, structured, and predictable. If we live in chaos externally, we tend to feel chaotic inside. So one of the most important things for people to understand is the benefit that comes from making certain every day that their days are structured and they have a balance, so that from the time they get up to the time that they go to sleep, people know how they're going to be occupying their time, because psychological misery loves empty space. And if we create a lot of empty space, if there's a big vacuum in our time, then horrible thoughts and feelings are very likely to rush in and fill that up for us. So I think probably the single most important thing for people to do in these times is to make certain that their days have a blend of work of some sort. If people are in a position where they can work remotely from their homes, then work of some sort, but that would also include work around the house or safely in their garden if that's possible. So some sort of productive, meaningful work every day, exercise every day within the limits of what the government tell us that what we're allowed to do, having social contact so we don't feel isolated from each other is crucial, but also making certain that we're doing things for peace and relaxation. It's a great opportunity. We've got a month or so where we can start to learn how to meditate or set up a yoga practice. And it's also crucial to have things to do every day that make us feel happy, if possible. Because unfortunately, part of the human condition, if we're left to our own devices, we tend to settle into a bit of a negative, pessimistic, kind of gloomy mood state. We have to work to keep ourselves happy. And if we're not doing things that make us feel happy, we tend not to feel happy. So it's really important that people have the opportunity to either foster things that they do for happiness, go back to things that they used to do previously for happiness, purely so that we've got activities every day that we can use to keep ourselves a little bit more positive and upbeat.
You might develop that discussion about feelings as we talk about how we function as ultra social beings, because normally we band together and that's a way of protecting each other and assisting one another. But you know, humans do need each other to survive and prosper. But there are some effects and risks of being isolated. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Being part of a group is enormously primitive and adaptive. Like you said, there's safety in numbers. There's safety in a group. We tend to fare much better if we're surrounded by people than if we're trying to get by in isolation. Keeping somebody in isolation is a time tested way of making them miserable. You know, solitary confinement's a hideous experience to inflict on somebody, we tend not to do particularly well if we're quarantined or isolated from other people. It links to just about every abnormal or unproductive maladaptive emotional state. We do best if we've got company.
Yes, and there are risks, aren't there, about loneliness. And a loneliness is in the literature, which is akin to isolation. And people may feel in a state of grief, of sadness, or being bored, or feeling lonely. I'm just also aware that loneliness in the literature has been associated with an increase in inflammatory markers, which actually decreases the immune response.
Well, it does. And that catches us in a nasty catch-22 situation where we're in the middle of a pandemic. We're doing whatever we can to keep away from infection. In order to be safe from infection, our immune system has to be in good functional state. But unfortunately, the more anxious we get, the more isolated we get, the more it tends to hit our immune system and the more vulnerable and susceptible we are to infection. Mm. So to keep ourselves fit and healthy and safe in these sort of times, it pays to look after our physical condition and our social distancing, but also to pay attention to our state of mind, because there's a very strong connection between our state of mind and our body defense system.
I just want to turn a little bit towards anxiety as a normal adaptive response to threat. How do you distinguish between what is normal and what is pathological?
I said before, anxiety is a normal reaction. There are a number of impacts of anxiety, though, that create a threshold between helpful anxiety that's going to keep you safe and unhelpful anxiety that entirely destroys the quality of your life. The first is distress. The more distressed we feel by our anxiety, the less helpful it becomes. And that's often a function of intensity. So the more intense anxiety becomes, the more distressing it becomes, and the more distressing it is, the less adaptive it is. And the other thing that happens with anxiety is the connection between a level of anxiety and our ability to perform. We all need a degree of anxiety to be able to perform well. Sports people, for instance, rely on a degree of pre-competition anxiousness to put them in a situation where they're going to be in their peak performance. As anxiety increases, our performance tends to increase and then plateau. But if we go beyond that in terms of a level of anxiety, our performance deteriorates and our ability to function falls off. So that's the other important factor that I would consider to differentiate ordinary anxiety from unhelpful anxiety. The first is the amount of distress that it makes us feel, and the second is the degree of impairment that it creates in our ability to function.
You talked earlier a little bit about chronic stress and the effects on the body, but what are the effects of chronic stress on the mind and body for that matter?
Persistent and sustained levels of emotional discomfort, whether it's sadness or anxiousness, very definitely has an adverse impact on our physiological state. There's a very strong connection, for instance, between depression, which is very closely related to anxiety, and loss of brain structure and function. Similarly, sustained anxiety, through the impact that it has on largely on our brain, on our body hormone system, which is largely mediated by cortisol, does tend to have a sustained negative impact on our body functioning. It increases the risk of conditions like high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes. It's a very, very long list of chronic physical health conditions that are very closely connected to sustained stress.
We do make responses and make choices which are psychological. Some of those choices are quite adaptive and some of them are not so healthy. Can you talk a little bit about what ways people use to cope with stress, both acute and chronic, that are healthy and unhealthy?
stress management and coping with stress, there are some general ideas and some universal ideas, but we're all wired up a little bit differently. And what helps to calm some but one person down may drive another person completely mad. But the general stress containers would be things like regular exercise, social contact, communicating about thoughts and feelings, distraction. Meditation is a very strong form of stress reliever. Some people would use things like humor to relieve stress, making certain that we have sufficient good quality sleep is fundamentally important to relieving stress. Less helpful ways of dealing with stress, like you said, oftentimes come down to choices. And some of the choices that we make about the behaviors that we use aren't particularly adaptive in terms of stress. For instance, we might choose to spend a lot of time online as a stress reliever. And while there's a lot of material online that's phenomenally helpful in terms of providing us with information, and there's an awful lot that we can read that's full of fear and unfortunately misinformation. So being careful about what we expose ourselves to online is important. We need to make important, helpful choices about what we eat and drink. A lot of people use food as a way of managing their stress. With being relatively confined for at least the next 3 or 4 weeks, it is important that we make careful, sensible choices with our food. Alcohol, obviously, people use as a way of containing stress. I think it's very important to bear in mind the guidelines in regard to healthy and safe drinking and do what we can to try and stay within those.
In the face of the future being so uncertain, one of the things that we do default to are irrational thoughts. For example, that the supermarket's going to run out of food. So it seems that training the mind is as important as training the body. And one of the tools that we have that has an effective evidence-based in treating anxiety is cognitive behavioural therapy. Can you explain what that is and how it works?
Cognitive therapy, particularly as it applies to anxiety, relates to the idea that it's not so much the things that we're dealing with that make us feel anxious, but the way that we think about them. And generally, when we are anxious, in our thoughts, we tend to be thinking about something that's in the future, and we tend to be thinking about that thing in a particular way. Specifically, we tend to focus our attention on how risky and dangerous something is, and at the same time, we focus our attention on how unlikely we are to be able to manage that perceived threat. So there's a gap between thinking about something in the future as a risk that we're not going to be able to deal with. And the bigger that gap, the more anxious we tend to get. So, for instance, I'm terrified of the dentist. The more I think about how dreadful the dentist is going to be, and the less able I am to keep myself safe, the more anxious I'm going to feel. If I can shrink down that gap by shrinking down how likely and how risky something is in the future, and if I think carefully about what I can do to be better prepared for that risk, I'll feel progressively less and less anxious. And if I can flip that so that I start to think that actually the future isn't too risky, and even if it was, I'm well prepared to deal with it, I'm going to feel confident rather than feeling anxious. So part of that involves having good, accurate information about how risky the future is. And a significant part of it is doing what we can to be resourceful and resilient so that we can back ourselves to be able to deal appropriately with dangerous things if they actually eventuate. Because we all know that a lot of the stuff that we worry about will never happen, but you can't rely on that because we equally know that bad stuff does happen. You can't stick your head in the sand and pretend that everything's going to be fine, because unfortunately for some of us it won't be. But we don't do ourselves any favours if we unnecessarily inflate the degree of risk in the future. And one example of that that I've heard a lot of people talking about with a lot of anxiety is the awful devastation that happened through the Spanish flu. And a lot of people are drawing a line of similarity between the coronavirus outbreak and the Spanish flu pandemic. And certainly the Spanish flu pandemic was a global catastrophe that killed somewhere between 40 and 50 million people. And we all focus on that, and it's terribly, terribly scary. But the important thing to bit of information to have that might relieve some of that anxiety is knowing that the Spanish flu happened in 1918, and a large proportion of people who died from the Spanish flu actually died from secondary bacterial pneumonia. And the important bit of information that a lot of people need to know is that antibiotics weren't discovered until 1928. So a huge number of people who died from Spanish flu died from a condition which, with modern antibiotic medication, is treatable. So a little bit of information can go an awful long way to rectify the imbalance in our thoughts when it comes to accurately determining how risky and dangerous something is. And without doubt, the coronavirus is a global threat, but we need to be careful that we're understanding accurately the extent of that effect so that we don't become caught up in what I've seen a lot, which is very counterproductive hysteria.
I mean, you've given a lot of advice already, very practical advice on coping. But are there any particular resources that you'd recommend to help people who are having difficulty dealing with their emotions and the effects of isolation?
Well, I think a universal, most important and accessible resource is talking to other people. I think if we can share our experiences with other people, if we can tap into their wisdom and experience and expertise, it's massively beneficial. Beyond that, there's a deluge of available how to deal with anxiety and stress options. There is a very well put together web page called CALM, which is an acronym for Computer Assisted Learning for the Mind. There are a number of smartphone apps that are well-researched and effective tools to help people deal with anxiety. One of them is called Headspace, which is a very, very straightforward, easy-to-follow, step-by-step training program using technique based on mindfulness-based meditation to relieve anxiousness. There's another very helpful smartphone app called Insight Timer, which is a huge library of guided meditations that can be enormously beneficial. Added to that, there are two or three very helpful books. One that I very commonly recommend is written by a British research psychologist. His name is Mark Williams, and the name of the book is simply called Mindfulness. Another book, it's written by Edmund Bourne. It's called The Anxiety and Phobia Workbook. There's a book that is written by Dennis Greenberger and Christine Podesky called Mind Over Mood, which is a very well-structured kind of do-it-yourself cognitive behavioral therapy program that has huge applicability to managing anxiety and worry.
So thank you, Rob, for sharing your expertise and for your time to talk about psychological and emotional states in this time.
Thank you for asking me to join you, Will.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.